Meantime, let us sing tonight for everyone in this diarrhea that will follow.
All right.
Our theme, united forever in friendship and labor, a mighty people shall end.
He's a socialist. Put your bees away.
Young shall live through the ages, a dream of the people, the fortress city. Lord, live this socialist motherland. It was built by the people's mighty hand. Lord, united and free. Lord, live our socialist dream.
Socialism forever.
About that sound, he'd love the sound that we, Algiers, that turned us on in that great movie of Algiers we have. And you know, give your neighbor a kiss, a little bit of love all around. Come on, diarrhea. Come on, diarrhea. Where's diarrhea? Uh-oh.
Give a round of applause for Mr. Don Free. Come on now, Mr. Don Free.
Seldom at a loss for words, but here's my little girl. To have come here to Jonestown from Washington, the city of lies, last week to what appears increasingly to me to be the kind of city of truth here, and read some of the stories and, more importantly, talk to people and see people. I really am at a loss for words. I won't be when I turn and talk about it.
Maybe I can sketch an overview of what's been called the
invisible government in the United States and build up questions and stuff. As you know, from living in the United States during this period, coming out of the hysteria and the witch hunts of the 50s and the Cold War, and the big assassinations in the 1960s, the war in Vietnam, Watergate and on the 70s brought to a close. All of you have lived through this family of animals, a summary of your own experiences, each one in their way, as a person of their time, and then here at Jonestown have somehow transcended a received reality and are making a new community, new identity, and setting up a model as a corrective against these decades of deception and deceit from Dallas to Watergate. Something happened on November 22nd, 1963, in Dallas, in Dealey Plaza, and again on the floor of the Audubon Ballroom in New York City, where Malcolm X lay dying in the arms of Gene Roberts, an undercover agent provocateur for the Bureau of Special Services, and then again in Memphis, and again in Los Angeles, again and again the shots rang out, the bullet and not the ballot determined our history, and America became the name of a nervous disease. There's one common denominator to these big murders that reached into every home in the land and changed every American's lives and indeed the people around the globe. Those murders and the subsequent cover-ups, the war in Vietnam, the Watergate scandals, all of them have one thing in common. Though they are different kinds of crimes, though they all represent organized violence on the part of the state and organized and official secrecy, there's still a deeper common denominator. And that is a concept, the idea of the right to know and the need to know. The Greeks called it ananke, the need to know. They put it at the level of physical survival, psychological, philosophical survival. It was not just a question of curiosity, that it was an absolute need to know in every area of human existence, and not the least, of course, in the political and social arena where great events in the name of history take us all up and cast us into the like straws into the winds of history. We need to know. We can face anything, no matter how terrible, but we cannot face lies, secrecy. We cannot continue when the information that we need to know to survive is kept from us. We can face the truth, no matter how terrible. We showed that in America in the Great Depression and in World War II, and we responded with resourcefulness and ingenuity and creativity. And indeed, Jonestown could not be, it's an example of many things, but it is certainly an exemplar of the Renaissance buried in the unconscious of the damned, who can hack out of the wilderness a city of man and of God. And certainly, courage is that process of making decisions in the light of all the information. Now, because I've come from Washington, and because I think the murder of Dr. King in many ways has echoes for Jonestown, I'd just like to say a few words about that particular tragedy. and what it is that is happening now. That unlaid ghost, those unlaid revenants, those crimes as in ancient tragedies that cry out for retribution and justice and information. Somehow in the unconscious, in the collective unconscious and the conscious of the American people, there is an awareness which found its full shape probably in the first few minutes after hearing about these murders. All the engines of government propaganda that spun out the stories of lone communists and racist fanatics and other types of the lone nut theory, all of those years were for naught. The statistics show that up into the 90 percentile, the American people reject the official explanations and believe profoundly that there is something moving invisibly, a secret government which has undermined their lives. They believe that, and these big murders and the cover-ups are the metaphors and the symbols for what otherwise is an everyday process that is difficult to coalesce or to get your hands on. But in Memphis, we come to the end of one road and the beginning of another. You know, there are a number of victims from April 4th, 1968. Martin Luther King, of course, the most significant, but there are a number of others. There was a woman who lived in a flop house. She heard a gunshot at 6:01 p.m. on April 4th, 1968. She recognized it because her father had been a great hunter in Arkansas. She saw a man come out of that community bathroom and walk down the hall quickly and down the stairs. She was the only witness, the only person on this globe that saw the murderer of Martin Luther King when he came out of that community bathroom. She was the FBI and the police witness, and based on her description, a drawing was put out on the wires worldwide. Weeks later, when James Earl Ray was apprehended by Scotland Yard based upon information of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police with no help whatsoever from American law enforcement in London, she was asked to sign the affidavit which was required to extradite him from London. She said, "Let me see his picture." They showed her. She said, "That's not the man. I told you the man I saw was in his late 50s. He was 5'3 or 5'4. He was quite dark-complected. And Ray at that time was 39, 5'11, and light-complected." They said, "Just sign it. We're sure this is the man. And if you sign it, you will receive $100,000 that the Memphis Press Scimitar and the Memphis Commercial Appeal, the two newspapers, have put up." She said, "I wouldn't lie for nothing, so I won't lie for $100,000. They said, "You're going to be in a lot of trouble if you don't sign this affidavit. If you ever testify when this man comes to trial, you're going to be in a lot of trouble." Well, she refused to sign it. She went home. And for the first time in Tennessee state history, two members of the homicide squad of the Memphis Police Department picked her up and took her to the mental ward of the John Gaston Hospital, where she was chained at the wrists, chained at the ankles, chained around the waist, and chained to a group of other people. They stood in the rain. She spent about 2.5 minutes before a judge, and she was remanded to the Western State Hospital in Bolivar, Tennessee, where she languished for 10 years. Well, we got her out this year in a series of somewhat audacious moves, both in the courtroom and outside the courtroom. We brought her to California. She is there.
It might fascinate you to know that we have studied this part of your work and we were interested very much.
When I arrived, people said Grace Walden, and I thought we couldn't get the story out in Los Angeles at first. And Grace Walden, indeed. She will have a $10 million lawsuit, $1 million for every year of her incarceration. We have her hospital records. The first entry reads, "Hold until after the Ray trial." Does that sound like a psychiatric observation to you? The next entry reads, "No telephone calls, no visitors. If anyone attempts to approach or contact, homicide." Memphis Police Department. Well, she lived with a man. escaped from the Jefferson City prison in Missouri in 1966. The only man ever to escape from that prison. He had help, some of which he knew about, and some of which he has now told us he did not know about. He was given help to that escape. And he didn't question the rest of the time. He was on the run for about a year, and in that time, he was able to work for a while outside of Chicago, and by the way, work with black people in a restaurant, as he had always worked with black people in prison and out. James Earl Ray is not the lantern-jawed racist, but he's been painted in order to rationalize this crime. He's a quiet man with self-taught, with a good sense of humor, and not a fanatic in any sense of the word. When asked before the House Select Committee in public hearings last week whether he was a racist fanatic, he refused, though in private he can be fairly eloquent in this matter, he refused to add so much as a false note. He said, "I don't know much about that. I figure most people black and white are out for themselves." He's a crook. He's a small-time crook, and he has a stubborn and consistent identity as a small-time crook. He has his own code that is never to inform and never to cooperate. He doesn't, he can't say who killed Martin Luther King. He can only say who didn't, and that's him. He has told us that, you see, a book came out by George McMillan stating that when Ray was in prison in Missouri in the 1960s, Martin Luther King would come on the television in Selma, that Ray's knuckles would turn white, that he would foam at the mouth, that he would be galvanized, underscored, into action, that he would mutter, "Somebody's got to get him. Somebody's got to get the son of a bitch." Well, when Mark Lane, when he first went to visit Ray and read that to him, because Mark had been arrested with Dr. King and had worked with Dr. King and wanted to make our position clear with Mr. Ray, he smiled and Mark said, "Is that funny?" And he said, "Yes, under the circumstances, we didn't have any television in the Jefferson State prison at that time." And Mark said, "Well, that can be checked." Talked with the assistant warden, Bill Armantrout, and there was no television at all until 1970, 3 years after Ray had escaped from Jeff City. Then, therefore, where did the book come from? With the New York Times and the Washington Post, and Time Magazine, and Newsweek called it the definitive biography of the assassin, and it was called The Making of an Assassin. He had descended from 10 generations of criminals, said George McMillan. Well, who is George McMillan? George McMillan is the husband of Priscilla Johnson McMillan, who first interviewed Lee Harvey Oswald in Moscow in 1960, who was questioned on November 26th as a suspect by the FBI in the murder of President Kennedy, and who babysat Marina Oswald for one decade until bringing out her book just recently. And when Marina Oswald appeared on television, she said that after reading Mrs. Johnson's book, she realized her husband must have done it alone. Marina, parenthetically, will be the chief witness in the Kennedy hearings coming up next month. And Priscilla McMillan Johnson, we now have the documents under the Freedom of Information file, was undercover as a news stringer in Moscow and was working for the Central Intelligence Agency. And when Svetlana Stalin, the defector from the Soviet Union and the Central Intelligence Agency's greatest single coup of the Cold War, Ms. Stalin was domiciled at the home of the parents of Priscilla McMillan Johnson in Pennsylvania, and there she and her husband George McMillan debriefed her, wrote and translated the book that was published and circulated around the world under the name of Svetlana Stalin. And that's the man who appeared last week on public television as the commentator who at every possible break would come in to tell the listening audience what was taking place as we sat in Washington at those open hearings. Now, we've begun to get behind this kind of paramilitary journalism. More and more, we are able to find the anatomy of a lie as it's calibrated, and sophisticated though it may be, as it's orchestrated through the news media. And the freedom of information movement in the United States has more and more begun to target in on this manipulation of the American people, this infantilization of the American people, this diet of lies and of subterfuge and of mythology that's being fed to people in constraint of the entire democratic system, which of course depends on information being available so that people can make decisions. So we were able to, despite this kind of unrelenting propaganda, get a House Select Committee set up. And we were able to do it because we brought in information that the FBI, which had had Martin Luther King under surveillance for a decade and a half, 24 hours a day, eyeball and electronic, sometimes as many as 50 agents, in Oslo when he went to get the Nobel Prize, in his church, in his office, in his home and in his study, at his friends, and in fact a burgeoning octopus of electronic surveillance that grew and grew and grew, encompassing finally all the people that Martin Luther King talked to and all the people that they talked to. And they had him in an electronic cage until 1 hour before the assassination, when that security was stripped away. 2 hours before the assassination, Ed Reddit, a black warrant officer who was on security, and the security had been reduced from 14 to 12 to 10 to 2 to 1 to none by 4 p.m. And remember, Martin Luther King died leading the most militant labor strike of the Cold War period, of sanitation workers who for 6 months paraded with wearing signs simply saying, "I am a man." It's not even for wages. It was a profound and bitter and militant strike, out of which came the AFSCME unions, the new urban unions, who may in the 1980s begin to fight the war unions for the dollars that now flow to the Pentagon. Out of the death in Memphis and out of the tragedy came the seeds of a new labor movement. Martin Luther King, when he died, when he was executed on that balcony, was no longer a Southern agrarian pacifist, no longer a country preacher. He was a Nobel Prize winner with a world following who said the war in Vietnam is but a symbol of a far deeper malady. And then he said prophetically, "Unless there are profound changes in this system, we will be marching in marches without end against the war in," and then he added, as if he could see the future, "the war in Angola, in Rhodesia, in Mozambique, in South Africa, in Guatemala," and they cheered. And at last, at the Freedom Ways dinner, in tribute to Paul Robeson, and W.E.B. Du Bois recalled the great, restless black genius of finally reaching to his left. He had been ostracized by the black bourgeoisie, by the UAW, by the liberal labor leadership, and by the black leadership, and he was left alone with the people, and he reached to his left, and they were going to bring a rainbow of people into Washington, of every hue and color, a poor people's march of 1 million strong, who would stay in the nation's capital while a raging war was prosecuted across the world and bring about what the FBI in their documents called a pre-revolutionary situation. He was prepared to fast to the death. He understood that his mentor, Mahatma Gandhi, was far more than a passive resistance, that he was prepared to use what Gandhi called the weapons of the brave, that he was prepared to die, and that when he spoke on those last nights at the Ebenezer and at the other churches, and finally in Memphis, and when he said, "I would like to live, longevity has its purposes, I've been to the mountaintop, I may not go there with you, but I have seen the promised land," that was not some metaphysical prophecy. He had received a letter which had been forged at the seat of government, as Hoover called the headquarters office in Washington, telling him to commit suicide. And Hoover had had an agent type it on a typewriter, which was then destroyed, wipe it for fingerprints, put it in an envelope, and send it with another agent to a state in the deep South, Florida, and there anonymously mail it to King, and so that it would seem that a Southern racist, that a fanatic, was telling King to commit suicide. Well, there was a fanatic. It was a racist, but he wasn't from Florida. He was from Washington, D.C. Now, James Earl Ray didn't have the power and didn't send that letter. James Earl Ray didn't spend $7.5 million, which the Bureau spent as they attempted to destroy the character of Martin Luther King. James Earl Ray didn't doctor tapes that allegedly contain sexual material and send them to Martin Luther King, which he in any case played with his wife, and they listened and they knew the FBI had sent them, and they knew the FBI was sending the anonymous letters and so on. James Zorro Ray did not stalk Martin Luther King, but the FBI did, and they were armed and dangerous, and they said in the words of William Sullivan, Hoover's top aide, ominously, "We must mark him now as the most dangerous Negro in the country," and later they said, "We must treat him as if he were Khrushchev." And one of the agents that gave us testimony, which we were able to take to the Congress to have this select committee set up, Arthur Murtaugh, professor of law now after 20 years in the Bureau, said that when the word came over in Atlanta, and that's where the Destroy King Squad was situated, in Atlanta, and that's what it was called, the Destroy King Squad. When the word came over the loudspeaker that Dr. King had been shot, he said that executives of the Destroy King Squad left their feet with joy, screaming, and King's code name to the Bureau was Zorro. They got Zorro. They finally got the son of a bitch. They got Zorro. That was the reaction. It was that Destroy King Squad which was in charge and conducted the only investigation of the death after April 4th, 1968. That doesn't even fit the definition of a cover-up. A Destroy King Squad, if they're covering up, are covering up for themselves. So the security was stripped away between 4 and 6 o'clock on April 4th. And who removed that black detective, that Memphis detective? A man named Frank Holloman, who was director of fire and police. He also removed the only two black firemen who had marched with Dr. King and who were in fire station number 2, right across from the Lorraine Motel. Did Holloman work himself up through the ranks? No. He'd been appointed director of fire and police just before the sanitation strike, and he resigned soon after the murder. For 25 years, Holloman had been a top executive in the FBI. The last 8 of those years, he had been in charge of security for Hoover's personal office in Washington, D.C., the hardest of hardliners, a member of the John Birch Society, and an activist. The blood-red footprints lead directly to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and in Washington last week, we were able to turn aside almost every caveat. McMillan and his book, The Making of an Assassin, was the boilerplate used by the Congress, and I must tell you that the black members of the Select Committee, to a man, were being blackmailed in this investigation. Again, sex is the coin of the realm. Over and over, in a sick and repressed society, sexuality, or even lies about sexuality. In the King case, for instance, a black actor was hired, and 2 white prostitutes, and a camera set up arranged so it would appear as if the film were shot through a glazed window and blinds in some cheap motel, with a soundtrack that was meant to be derived from an electronic bug inside. Well, it was all staged, and it was going to be done with very poor lighting, and then passed off as films of an orgy involving Martin Luther King and 2 white women. So if you feel that if you're ever led to doubt, well, maybe there is something so terrible that, as the Mr. Pottinger of the Justice Department told Abby Mann before the NBC program on Dr. King's life, he said, don't get into the conspiracy. It'll just bring out the scandal, and it'll ruin the symbol of the civil rights movement and so forth. Well, we know that the FBI, when Dr. King would go to a house that was secluded where he could get away from the telephone to write, on one of those occasions, firemen kicked down the front door, and the news media came in behind them. Well, they found Dr. King writing a book. The FBI thought that he might be there with someone and had set that up. Later, when Joe Lowery, who's now the president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, one night in Selma, Dr. King had left, but most people thought he was still there. In the middle of the night, 2 very attractive women appeared at the door and said they'd had a flat tire and could they use the telephone. And they asked if they could spend the night. Lowry said he'd ask his wife. And they left. The point was that they thought Martin Luther King was there. And though the news media shamefully, over the years, spread this raw sewage from the files of the FBI, most of it was fake. Don't ever be bluffed by this. Anyone who's as active, and Sullivan told Abby Mann that Martin Luther King had said something that though he hated King, he had to respect. He listened to, as the man in charge of the COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, he had access to the King tapes. And King had said, I'm not going to take it anymore. I'm going to rent time on national television. And I'm going to say to the country, I'm just a human being. I have my foibles and faults like anyone else. I'll be glad to take responsibility for the fact that I'm human and all too human. But what has that to do with justice? What has that to do with human rights? And even Mr. Sullivan of the FBI was impressed with that. Well, they could not stop King. He had come out straightforwardly against imperialism. He had begun to demand economic justice and economic rights, far beyond civil rights, far beyond integrating lunch counters. He was asking that the American people make a choice between how those dollars were going to be spent. He was going to keep 1 million people in Washington, and he made that detour through Tennessee. Now, on March 28th, the strikers' march turned into violence, and Martin Luther King was hustled away by Reverend James Lawson and others to the Holiday Inn, Rivermont. We now know that violence was started by young black men wearing leather jackets posing as members of a group called the Invaders, a militant group. They were agent provocateur of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and we know that now, and we know the instigator's name, and his name is McCullough, and you've seen his picture 1,000 times without knowing it. He's the unknown man bending over Martin Luther King the moment he was shot, and then pointing like that. And that famous picture of Jesse Jackson and the others pointing to what was thereafter called the Sniper's Lair, they were reacting to McCullough pointing like that. McCullough was a Memphis Police Department officer, undercover, an agent provocateur who the documents tell us also worked for the FBI. Now, that's a strange arrangement if you know how police and FBI often are mutually exclusive, and later went on to work for other government agencies. He was armed the day Dr. King was shot, and he had a rifle in the car. And James Earl Ray, supplied with documents that we gave him, identified him nationally on television last week in Washington. Now, the fact that the press did not dwell on that is not the point. We have no illusions, but we have begun to follow the blood-red footprints. On the 28th, the violence was caused, and the police waited ominously blocks ahead, and the march moved forward as if into a cul-de-sac. And James Lawson now thinks that there was going to be an attempt to murder Dr. King that day. Mace was used for the first time in the streets of an American city, and a young black man was killed. And Martin Luther King, of course, would never leave a city where there was violence. He would come back to have a march, a nonviolent march. Well, Robert Byrd, now the Democratic leader of the Senate, perhaps the third most important man in our governmental structure, went on the floor of the Senate on March 29th, and he said, Martin Luther King leaves a trail of violence wherever he goes, and now he's going to bring his poor people to Washington, to the black hole of despair with pigs and chickens, while he himself, this erstwhile Messiah, conducts a lay-in in a posh Washington hotel. Well, those code words were not made clear until years later. The Bureau referred to Dr. King as the Messiah. The lay-in refers to the sexpionage that we now know about. And the posh hotel refers to a letter from Hoover to Robert Jensen, the special agent in charge in Memphis, giving him news stories to feed to the media, not to be attributed to the Bureau, with headlines, prefabricated, do as I say, not as I do, King says. Martin Luther King comes here to Memphis, and he tells black people to boycott white business. Yet he stays in the fine Holiday Inn, Rivermont. Why doesn't he stay in a decent, Negro Hotel, like the Lorraine. They put him in that shooting gallery. His reservations were changed. He was getting pressure from Washington and from Memphis that he was staying in a white hotel, and he moved to the Lorraine, which has no interior corridor, which has only outer balconies. J. Edgar Hoover, not James Earl Ray, put Martin Luther King into that shooting gallery. Well, I'm just hitting on some of the highlights, but I'm indicating, I think, why we feel that this is a jackpot case, and why, if we can carry through to the end with our Citizens Commission group, and I must say, Mark Lane, though we have the documents now about how Mark Lane is to be smeared, they say that he's in it for the money, say that, and there's a number of things, and indeed, that's been the case over the years, but in fact, he's put in hundreds of thousands of dollars, all the money from his considerable lecturing and writing. I put in what I could, and we have a group of outstanding people who are having testimonial dinners every other week to raise money and so forth, just a few people. But the power of the truth, of the power of information, Martin Luther King said that truth crushed to earth will rise again. I think it's true. There is something about the use of truth when told to power. It has a kind of career of its own. And little by little, we have seen the conditions change so that we have no doubt that James Earl Ray will receive a trial next year in Memphis, and he will sit there with black ministers who were close to Dr. King sitting next to him. We will smash this white, poor white racist against black people, this most ancient of the American stereotypes of pitting poor white rednecks against poor blacks, so that liberals are paralyzed with guilt and dare not investigate. We will smash that. There will be notable black people sitting next to James Earl Ray. His lawyer is a notable white lawyer of the left. Ray himself has a class consciousness without question, though a stubborn criminal identity, an equally clear class consciousness. We've taken a house in Memphis. There will be a trial. There is no case whatsoever against him. The bullet can't be linked to the gun. Everything you may have ever heard turns out not to be true. And when he walks out, it then, into that vacuum, rushes the terror and the pity that has been banked and leashed in for so long as to who slew the dreamer on April 4th, 1968. And then, I think, the feeling can be broadcast that there is treason in the land. There has been a stab in the back. There has been subversion, but it has not been some foreign power. It has not been some foreign power's communist fifth column. The people who yelled and screamed stab in the back, the Nixons, the Hoovers, the profiteers of the Cold War, they are the power behind the invisible government. Remember the Central Intelligence Agency, the FBI, the local police, these are small groups. The Rockefellers, the Trilaterals, these are small groups. Not just a handful of people. There are perhaps between 10 and 20 million people who identify with the ruling class in America. Now, that's perhaps less than a fifth of the population, but it's a lot of people. You know, there's a lot of false consciousness in there, but that does not matter until you can change that consciousness. So it's a very desperate struggle. But we intend to ventilate these murders and to offer up a structure of invisible government. And indeed, in 1973, before the big revelations of Watergate, when asked what they fear most, according to the Harris poll, 88% of the American people said not Black Panthers, not hippies, not communists. They said the use of intelligence agencies by American officials to circumvent the electoral process. Now, the American people, if they're able to answer in the 88th percentile that that's what they fear most, then you have a very, very thin veneer of consensus in the country. It's very volatile. These murders are the linchpins to to the consciousness, we think, of the 1980s. Well, Martin Luther King, I think, if he could see Jonestown, he would recognize it as the next step in his agenda. And he would say, one, two, three, many Jonestowns.
Any questions? He said the mic didn't carry his voice.
Questions?
Right, I'll repeat them. Or you got the microphone, good.
We must fight them. We'd like to ask you if, what do you think the possibilities of your own life being in danger, due to the fact that you're such a dedicated person, to uncovering the truth?
Would you believe that that is always the first question? But I think it tells something about where we are, that that is always the first question. And perhaps this should be the last one as well, and the ultimate one. Well, character assassination, as we've been talking about, and then physical assassination.
I am ready to defend my homeland.
Can be talked about together.
And consolidate.
Now, assassination, political assassination, you know, is not a crime of passion in the traditional sense. It's a crime of political passion. And there are some axioms about these crimes. For the conspirators, it is equally important not just to remove the troublesome figure, who in any case often can be replaced, and in any case, assassination is a sign of weakness, always. But equally important, and sometimes more important, is who will it appear committed the crime? Because political assassination is meant to affect a change in the relationship of forces in a culture. And if murdering someone simply throws suspicion on the murderers, it hasn't achieved anything. And I think we often tend to be simplistic about how we think of these. Assassination is the absolute last option of a conspiracy. And it is a reckless one because it signifies, signifies weakness in this way. It takes power to murder the president in the streets of Dallas. It's true. However, the conspiracy was not powerful enough to overcome Johnson and the administration's interposition of the lone nut theory. The murder in Dallas was depoliticized. Oswald was a communist, but he acted alone. The conspirators obviously believed they went to great trouble. I haven't talked about that tonight, but in Mexico City, an entire scenario was set up to make it appear to be a Soviet-Cuban conspiracy in order to unleash a full-scale attack on Cuba coming out of Dallas. You think not for a moment that John Kennedy would have been murdered if the conspirators had known that it wasn't going to lead to anything. But a Warren report, and then decades of trouble and doubt, they assumed that, just what Johnson assumed, that World War III was at hand, and he had to demand of CBS, New York Times, and the others that they stop talking about conspiracy, since conspiracy had to be a left-wing conspiracy, had to be a communist conspiracy because of our Cold War mentality, and therefore Johnson, though we excoriate him for the cover-up of the Kennedy case, history will probably have a kind word to say for him, because he believed that World War III was at hand, and he convinced Earl Warren that they must stop this conspiracy talk and depoliticize it, because, and the left went along, and liberal America went along, because they too were taken in by the communist cover that had crudely been set up for Lee Harvey Oswald. So when you talk about whether someone is going to be assassinated, if they're identified with the exposure of a crime, it's probably the best insurance they can have. But in any case, as I receive my COINTELPRO files, and I see a number of things that were done, and a leaflet that was printed, which could have led to physical violence, which would have, by the way, have been blamed on the Black Panthers. It was a forged leaflet calling for something to be done to me, but it would have been blamed on the Panthers, and that was equally important. But you have to ask, I think, whether one you are safer knowing or not knowing. You talk about this need to know. There's also a fear of knowing, and people who know that, they want to turn away, but that's a variant on the need to know. They're caught between wanting to know and fearing to know. But the problem is that you're always aware that you're afraid of knowing, so that in the name of survival, in fact, you choose an existence that is an existence in itself, not for itself, an existence that is simply a mechanical twitching to the stimuli of the gods from the machine that spread the propaganda of the culture. And you walk around a bundle of secrets in your personal life and afraid of these secrets in your political life, alienated with everyone's hand against everyone else. In fact, you live in a madhouse as America became a madhouse during the 1960s. And the people in America became mad people. Unless, as George Orwell said, and as I think is exemplified by the People's Temple, by Jim Jones, and by others who were able to stand alone, Orwell said, "There is truth and there is untruth, and if you clung to the truth even against the whole world, you were not mad." I think a few people kept their sanity and provided a way out and a model so that other people could come back from the madness that was American life. Now, Jonestown is a spectacular example. There are other much more modest, smaller groups and individuals who have found a niche for themselves, a way to keep working, and a way to act out their sanity in their daily life. If you ask, are they shortening their lives or threatening their lives by so doing, you would have to compare that with what? With the alternative. A mindless, meaningless life just for yourself. To paraphrase, you know, Dostoevsky said that without Jesus Christ, the people cannot live and will not die. We in our time can say that without the people, we cannot live and will not die. There's one thing that I'd like to say to you, Don. I think perhaps I've not heard any such courage. The eloquence, and of course that I was contemplating, that the very eloquence is threatening. The eloquence is threatening. There are legal things telling you of some of the episodes of this stuff. For no reason. Marshall,
there are lone nuts too.
Honestly,
I thought it was about to say that I really believe what you are presenting. We have studied this, and everything you said verified what we knew, and you've even added more to it. We studied it very closely because we know people can opt for conspiracies, even ourselves. We want to be sure before we conclude that we have a conspiracy against us, because we feel to us a peaceful community, it doesn't seem like we could warrant all the goddamn money and so forth. Except often we thought maybe just the love-hate syndrome, but now you have provided, by the way, some very fascinating things for us, which we're not going to go into. And as he feels liberty, because we always have to take that possibility, as the foreign minister said, that there is the CIA agent sitting in this very pavilion. But the one thing I want to offer to you, and I know I can do so on behalf of the council, he has a beautiful 3.5-year-old son, the adoption mixed blood, that we will at any time take care of that child all the time while you're on your missions without cost to you in any way. I'm sure you see we give the very best thing. And I know one worry to me has always been the biggest thing with my loved ones, which unfortunately grew to 1,200. And sometimes I don't think I can meet it. But I want to extend that offer, the best of care to your loved ones, because often that is where you have to reach a good meeting. He represents a wealth of information. That's the least we can do. And if anyone else has questions, feel free.
And I'll also stay around afterwards. I'll close by saying this, and then I'll stay around to talk with people. Peaceful group dedicated to creativity, such as the People's Temple, trying to practice love and ingeniously attempting to humanize the heartless environment of the super-industrial state, why would they be a threat? Now, beyond the answer of offering an alternate system, making a model of socialism, by the way, one should never underestimate what a model this big is a big model. When the word gets out around the world, there will be repercussions for decades to come. The end is not yet in sight for Jonestown. There will be many dialectical and exponential changes as this creativity comes back literally on the waters. So I'm not saying that that's not terribly threatening. It is, but why should it bring about violent means rather than political means of struggle? Well, you know, in world drama, there was always a mystery of why Iago, Othello's lieutenant, why he was so evil. And it was always called the problem of Iago. Was it pure evil? Was he the devil? Was he Machiavelli? Why did he torture that good man? But you know, the answer is in the play, and it's the answer, it's the reason beneath the reason for conspiracy. Paraphrasing Iago and talking about someone else, he said, "There is a beauty in his daily life that makes me ugly." And extrapolating that, there is a beauty in your daily life that makes them ugly and they cannot tolerate, so prepare for struggle.
I think that this is so, we can't say, in there's no way that words would express our gratitude for his presence. We've read his works, discussed his works on many occasions, having met the author and seen the consistency of his character means so much to us. We will, I think, do with the postponed agricultural matters, let the analysts resolve. I think the people can clear with that. Are there any particular point of success? We all like these successes. This has been a rainy year. Perhaps it's going to be the worst year that we will see in some time. Even some of the government has suggested that it's weather modification of your visit. We do not. Anyway, we know that it's very important that we all cooperate with the analysts, all the various departments, because in the next few days, we don't get to plan.
That's right.
But we can be assured of ourselves sustaining ourselves, because we are determined people. We came a long way.
My toes just jumped up like that.
He ought to be held.
You know,
and
my old man.
I'm not
stop listening to the words of my blood. People are prepared to accept.
Are dead,
and there would have been nothing that we could achieve.
That's the one thing that haunted me as I saw this good man talk. I wondered, what is it about the American people that they can see the purpose? Our movement is everywhere. We save the senior citizens' escort service and the establishment movement. We save so many of you that were on drugs, in crimes, gangs. We save the U.S. citizen figures, undoubtedly, thousands, millions, just the loss of our chance. The welfare, the number of you that were on welfare. The SSI portion of the check, which is a high degree of your income. Please, we save them now. We saved them from some of our young men like Greg, who was quite an effective criminal. That would have cost a lot of money, of course. You know what I mean? The kids that were angry and alienated, that took their violence out on the institutions of capitalism, which are understandable, that empathize with them. But we have got to get some money in. We can't depend on our folk at home. Too bad I can't get there. Discussing certain ways that it may be possible for me to get into certain states even where we could rally. But a lot of people will not forget what was done for them through the people's campaign. Will not forget some of the fantastic healings. Will not forget even that we reached as far away from Chicago and New York to help some of their children in racist courts. I think we've got to think of every way, any conceivable fashion that we can come up with funds so we can not only get the conspiracy against us, but find what in the hell is going on that conspires us against goodness and gets by with it so effectively that we're not for this gentleman and Mark Lane. Let's sweep this shit right under the rug. And even I heard Voice of America say yesterday that they doubted now that James Earl Ray had damaged himself. I mean, you can give him a new trial. I'm glad to hear the evidence you gave me. The courage must that be hopeful that he will get a new trial. But I have nothing further to say. I assure you that to be a sanctuary, we would, if we had to, sell our bodies. Some of us have. I have. We will see if this place continues. I do not want us to ever have to resort to violence. That's the one beautiful thing we've had as much as we've been given. We never have. I don't want us to set that kind of example because this is the vision of Martin Luther King. I knew him, got to know a little of him when we received a joint award from the NAACP. He told us one thing, which is probably quite true. When I spoke of my atheism, he said, you ought to be church with you when you're talking about Jack Lake preachers and talking about there ain't no hell and there ain't no heaven and the fucking blood of Jesus didn't do us a goddamn bit of good. Peace. And so we are unified. We're not unified around the personality. Replacing Jesus with another Messiah, replacing false illusions of the past with working socialist democracy. And this man has given me the first hope that we can get on the top of some of this and perhaps cause Stone, who's undoubtedly sick, whatever the hell he's working for, wherever he's getting his money. This man, if he gets enough, if he becomes exposed for some of his activities, if he ever wants, I think there's an area in which I believe I heard from last night's communication that Charles Taylor very encouraged that he's perjured himself. I don't know if he said Mark, one of my better days, but he has perjured himself. Oh, Walter Duncan, a businessman, being able to use
He perjured himself.
Wait a minute. Just a minute.
He admitted that he had said something that I believe was perjury. Now, if there's any goddamn way we can get stoned, the court will crack. The only reason this shit is going is because...